Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Dr. Sharif Akili, resident physician at Stanford Hospital and investor at Polaris Partners. Join Sharif in exploring the extraclinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Our guests today are Arthur Kleinman and Paul Farmer, with special guest host Nick Cuneo. Before we go into this interview, I wanted to give a huge thanks to an old classmate and good friend of mine, Nick Cuneo, who co-hosted this episode with me. Nick is an assistant professor and med peds hospitalist at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. But more than that, he is an inspirational clinician who has worked closely with Arthur and Paul and devoted his career to immigrant and refugee health. He was a Doris Duke research fellow in Haiti, a Fulbright research fellow in South Africa, and now he's the guy currently opening up Johns Hopkins Asylum Health Clinic in Baltimore. I was really incredibly lucky to have Nick join me in this episode to interview these two giants in their field. So thank you so much, Nick. I'll be first introducing Dr. Kleinman. Arthur, you're a clinical psychiatrist and medical anthropologist, having trained at Stanford, Harvard, and MGH. You have a particularly, you've contributed particularly to understandings of cultural psychology in China and Taiwan, where you've conducted research since 1968, indeed from 2008 to 2016. Arthur, you've served as Harvard's University's Asia Center Director, and you've published and written over 300 papers and books, and your most recent book, which I just had the privilege to finish, The Soul of Care, came out last month in paperback. It's an incredibly touching ode to your life's work and personal experience surrounding caregiving, which could not be more relevant these days as COVID-19 has exposed real challenges we're facing and taking care of our elderly. Arthur, thank you so much for joining us. Before we introduce our next guest, for our listeners who may not be familiar with your work, how would you describe medical anthropology and your work in that field as a clinically trained psychiatrist?
Well, you know, there are many ways of describing medical anthropology, and Paul probably has his own definition, but what attracted me to the field in the first place was that it was a systematic way of looking at the lived experience of patients, communities, and doctors. And it gave you a legitimacy to bring context like social class, jobs, poverty, and history into the equation of understanding the people in front of you who you were speaking to and helping. And I saw it, though I didn't realize how it could be fully developed this way, until Paul came along. I saw it as being useful also to clinical medicine.
And could you mention a little bit about how that fit into Kleinman rounds I've heard so much about?
Well, I started trying to bring medical anthropology and medicine together when I was at the University of Washington from 1976 to 1982. And I began there something which eventually got called Kleinman Rounds, but was a clinical rounds in which I brought anthropology graduate students and residents and medical students together to see patients who were asked to have a consultation for psychological, psychiatric, or cultural or ethical reasons. And since I covered those fields, I could bring it together. And it started kind of an interesting, sort of ironically, because I think on the third or fourth round that I had, I got a call from the son of one of the people we had seen, one of the patients we'd seen, who happened to be in charge of the major pharmacy system in Seattle. And he said to me, I hear you just brought a group of medical anthropologists around to see my mother. And I said, yes, we wanted to see if we could contribute something to her care. And he said, what do you think, she is a cave woman? And I said, well, Well, that's not the kind of anthropology we're talking about, and I kind of explained it to him. I had to do a lot of that explaining. So I think the difference, since you want to, in some quick way, get to the difference between the eras that the era in which I worked and the era in which Paul worked and the era in which you and Nick are working, is that in my day, it was really odd to have social science and medicine come together. There were people who did it who were older than me, like the late Rene Fox, who just died a week or so ago, David Mechanic, a few others, but there weren't too many. And most of them were rather remote from the clinical setting, whereas what interested me was making it directly clinically relevant.
That's really incredible. That's really incredible. And definitely paved the way for others to try similar things across disciplines, but especially in anthropology, as we'll hear from Paul in a moment too. Thank you, Nick. I'll let you take it over from here.
Great. So I have the privilege of introducing Dr. Paul Farmer. Paul's an infectious disease expert and medical anthropologist, having trained at Duke, where we first met, Harvard, and Brigham and Women's Hospital. In addition to his role as an adjunct professor at Harvard, he's currently chief of the Division of Global Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he's the co-founder of Partners in Health, a global health organization that has saved countless lives with its work building hospitals and medical facilities in countries like Haiti, Sierra Leone, Russia, Rwanda, and Peru. He's written extensively on health, human rights, and the consequences of social inequality and inequity, and he is publishing his 12th book, I believe, which is Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds, Ebola and the Ravages of History, which has a release date of November 17th, 2020. I've already put in my order. I'm so excited to finally get to read this book, which provides such an important perspective on why and how the Ebola epidemic unfolded the way it did in West Africa. Very important lessons for the world today as we tackle COVID-19. Paul, for our listeners who, for whatever reason, have not yet gotten the chance to read your work, how would you describe your career in medical anthropology as a clinically trained infectious disease doctor?
Well, I got into this as an undergraduate by taking a course called medical anthropology. And I'll tell you that the reason I took the course is because it had the M word in it, not the anthropology word. I would have taken anything that was, I took medical ethics for the same reason. And Arthur Kleinman had just published his first book, as chance would have it, and it was being used to teach this class. And, you know, I reached out to him. He was at the University of Washington at the time. And he wrote back, lo and behold. And we've been friends ever since. And the reason I bring that up in answering that question is because I, too, got into this because I was interested in how anthropology might be useful, practical, and illuminate the practice of medicine, especially across boundaries of race, class, gender, language, etc. So that's how I got in, and I never imagined that I would, you know, become a, you know, professor of anthropology or medical anthropology, and you know, I'm so grateful that I am, but it just, it didn't seem like a probable or a likely career, given that I wanted to spend so much time in Haiti and other places practicing medicine with colleagues, but it worked out.
Yeah, certainly did. Well, I think that would, you know, be a natural transition to talking a little bit more about the relationship between you and Arthur as a mentor and mentee dyad and then colleagues.
So this question's for you, Dr. Farmer. How would you describe your relationship with Arthur? How did you come to be his student and how has that shaped you?
Well, in general, when contemplating this question, I tend to think of the seven stages of Arthur and Paul. Don't worry, I'm making this up as I go along. I'm sure I could fill in the seven stages. No, the point that I would make is that relationships change over time. Of course, you know, you're gathering your own experience as you move forward. And I mentioned just in introducing my career as a medical anthropologist that I reached out to Arthur. And, you know, I was an undergraduate at Duke. I'd never met him before. He had just written this book, and that was that's a slender basis for acquaintance. But, you know, that's the great thing about a university or a network of them. You know, when I wrote him, it was not unreasonable to think he might answer, and he did. And so that's how our relationship began, with a very generous response to an excited gesture. You know, I read Arthur's first book, which was called Patients and Healers in the Context of Culture, and thought, I want to do this. And of course, that's always wrong. You don't want to imitate someone's career entirely, but it's not a bad thing to imagine that you would like to imitate their career, because that allows you to go through the exercise of thinking what it might be like. And then, of course, I became his student, formally his student. I was a little bit afraid of him back then. I personally believe that he is mellowed very substantially, as they say out there in California where you are. You know, of course, we had not been through the things that we would go through in our lives, including those that we would go through together. We hadn't been through them yet. So over the years, then, you know, if I were just to think, it was Arthur as mentor in a classroom and with written materials, and then mentor for a career in academic medicine, and then a fellow teacher and sometimes fellow clinician and often fellow program builder. Over the years, you know, the relationship changed, but we always had a lot in common. We had each other, our friendship and friends and family, but also reading and writing and teaching that sustained and still sustains us to this day. We're still reading, writing, and teaching together. That may have been a little long.
Yeah, no, I love it, Paul. Arthur, do you think, you know, when Paul first reached out to you, you anticipated the type of relationship that you have today? Did you sense his enthusiasm? How did that relationship sort of create?
He would be my boss today. No. But I'm thankful he is. He was, I would say that you learn from your students. I learned an enormous amount from Paul. And he changed me. My wife changed me. Paul changed me. I learned, Paul is the most remarkable human being I have met in my life. I can honestly say that. And that's why I tried to support him, help him in any way that I could, and contribute to that wonderful trajectory that he's sustained and built on. You know, I've had my own trajectory, and there are areas where we have a direct overlap in our interests and areas where we have somewhat different interests. But the wonderful thing was that we started by writing together, by reading together, by writing together, by teaching together. And we've continued. And so right now we're teaching a course. We'll teach it tomorrow together, where we and two others, wonderful colleagues who were former students of mine, but have the same relationship with them that I have with Paul. Paul, I feel, is the icon of the field of global health. And he does what's critical in that field, and he's brought to bear critical ideas. I see myself as contributing to the field of global health, but my interest is also in, you know, I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm interested in individuals in a deep sense in their context. Paul is too in that regard, but that's what I feel is my particular specialty. And finally, in this latest book you talked about, I turned the searchlight on myself and looked at myself, which wasn't so easy. As Paul said, I was a tough mentor at an early stage, but I learned to be a mellower one. I think it's great that, you know, I'm almost 80 years of age. Paul is what, 25 still? No. He's up there at close to 60. And I feel like I have just the warmest feeling for him. And I would do anything for him. So, you know, he's like I've always told my kids, you know, I've got one son and one daughter. They're fabulous people. I've always told them we had two sons in the family.
Pretty good feeling.
Well, I was looking over AIDS and Accusations, I was just reading through the preface, and you referred to Arthur as, you said, his students know him as the principal architect of a community of scholars that takes seriously the study of social construction of illness without losing sight of the sufferers. And I just wonder sort of how, Arthur, you know, if you could take us a little bit through that process of being sort of an architect for this community that had not yet existed, and sort of how you thought about it at the time, and how you brought Paul into the fold and sort of became a mentor to him and others, and so many others, including me.
Well, first, and you know, a lot had to do with one of my mentors, Leon Eisenberg, who was although he himself was not a medical anthropologist, was a very committed social medicine physician and a politically active man. And felt that medical anthropology, medical history were very important. And so Leon and I got a grant from but it really was Leon's relationship that brought it in, from the MacArthur Foundation that funded a MD PhD program. And Paul and Ann Becker and Jim Kim and Lawrence Cohn were some of the early people who were on that MD PhD. And then we had side by side.
Sorry? Is it a pretty good track record you got there?
It's a pretty good track record, yeah. So in a way, that group, I think, was a very special group of people. But we've had excellent other kinds of students. Paul and I have had other kinds of students, many PhD students who do not have MDs. Some of them are just fabulous in what they've contributed along the way. We've had MA students who are either medical students or physicians who took a year off or 2 years off to really learn medical anthropology. We've had thousands of undergraduates. And so I think we've had what you could call a community of students. And I think what Paul particularly brought to that community, in my view, was a deeper appreciation than I had at the beginning, and a real commitment to the way that political economy shapes illness and care. And although I certainly was aware of it and realized some of its ways of acting, I didn't catch the full thing. And the same thing, the same way that I think it was our students who made us more aware of the role of colonialism in the shaping of global health. I mean, I was aware of that, but again, it wasn't as deeply engaged as some of our students became. Paul has always been very knowledgeable about the role of race in care. And again, I think I came laterally to see how important that is. And so there's a kind of a yin-yang complementarity in us, I think, that someday historians will figure out. But I think we work together Well, and you know, I've never been, there are a lot of academics who are careful about who they choose. They don't want to have someone who's smarter than them or more energetic than them or will do better than them. I've had just the opposite perspective. I wanted to have the best students who were going to go out there and do great things that would far surpass what I was able to do. And that was, for me, that was really important. And so we've had along the way some really great, great people. And for example, just to mention some, Ann Becker is now the Dean of Clinical and Academic Affairs at Harvard Medical School. Jim Kim is the former head of the World Bank. Lawrence Cohn has for decades run one of the great programs in medical anthropology at Berkeley. And I could go on and on and on and to more recent students like Clara Hahn, who's at Hopkins with you. Or for that matter, since you work with me as an undergraduate, Jeremy Green, who's out there heading the Institute of History at Hopkins. We've had a lot of people in our circle. And I think that that's been one of the best things about us. A kind of Catholic, for Paul with a capital C, for me with a small C, a Catholic embrace of broadly interested and people who did good work. And I think that's been the hallmark of what I would call, Paul's too modest to say this, but modesty was never my problem, a Harvard school that I don't think really in a way is restricted to medical anthropology. I think in a way, the better name for it is the Harvard School of Social Medicine, in which medical anthropology, medical history, and other fields have contributed significantly. What do you think, Paul?
I agree. I mean, about the fact that the rubric that is broader than medical anthropology, a discipline that, you know, you really launched in this country and in these times. But the group that comes together, many of them are interested in medical anthropology, as Arthur and I are, but all of us are interested in social medicine. And it's a comfortable rubric to fit under, you know. I was just, when you were talking about mentorship, I was just, I had just found at dinner the night before last, my wife found a picture of Arthur and our daughter, our older daughter, who's an adult now. And, you know, this is when she was a baby. And so in addition to forming, if there is such a thing, a Harvard school or constituting one, one of the reasons we do that is because we're a network of friends and who share these interests that were forged in a classroom, really, usually, but which have spread into the rest of our lives as well. And that's pretty wonderful feeling to have so much regard for the people that you work, you know, with whom you work on a daily basis.
Paul, and I guess Paul and Arthur, do you guys find that it was important that you were both institutionally at Harvard, the same institution, to have foster that relationship over time? Or do you find that it's possible for those bonds to maintain? I mean, Arthur, you just talked about your pupils, your mentees, your family tree who have gone on to other areas geographically, maybe even in other disciplines. Do you find that your relationship has been able to be maintained because you're co-teaching still in the same city, in the same institution? Or do you have advice for future trainees who want to be able to develop and foster and cultivate such relationships and may not have the privilege of being able to necessarily be linked with the same institution or geographic locale?
Sure. This is my 44th year at Harvard. How many years are you, Paul?
37, six.
There. So, you know, that's a long time with us at the same institution. But I would say that we could have done this at Duke, at Johns Hopkins, at University of Washington. Harvard has given us the best of students. Let's be very honest about that. It's attracted incredible students because of its mystique. But both Paul and I had to go out and raise the funds to make this happen. And for example, I mentioned that Leon Eisenberg had brought in an important MacArthur Foundation grant. Byron Good and myself had a NIMH grant, which for 25 years trained medical anthropologists and physicians. And then I brought in a whole bunch of other grants from the Carnegie Corporation, from the MacArthur Foundation, from the Friedman Foundation that supported groups. So not all of our groups are visible around, you see at Harvard. Paul has, he'll talk about it. I mean, the University for Global Health Equity in Rwanda is his huge activities in Haiti and in many other places. But I helped train the senior cohort of academic psychiatrists in China, and also the senior cohort of anthropologists in China, many of whom have become medical anthropologists because in China it's easier to do than other forms of anthropology. So I don't think we are one institution, but I don't think that is the story. The story is of nodes, various nodes, and Harvard is one of them. And I'll say one other thing about Harvard, which is that we've had great colleagues, great students, but Harvard made clear that we would have to find our own money for things. And that's exactly what Harvard does with everyone. That's actually, in my view, the hidden sauce for Harvard's success, its continued success, that it invests in very little that is for you as a professor. You've got to build your thing. And then there are certain ways that will help you. For example, the Asia Center helped me in a number of different ways. And for Paul, the structure of the medical school and the global health department has helped him. But he built that. The department is 10 times larger under Paul than it was when I chaired that department. And so we were entrepreneurial, but entrepreneurial for others, on behalf of others. So if you want to get to something that's important, and we just don't have much time, let me just say that Paul and I and a number of other people in our circle are committed to doing good in the world, which sounds like a very silly, superficial sort of thing. But I think for us is a lived experience, that for a variety of reasons, that's what we wanted to do. We weren't looking for fame, weren't looking for fortune, weren't looking for some administrative success or something. We were looking to do good in the world in the ways that we could do it. That's what I've always believed Paul was about, and that's why I was so taken to him and wanted to help him. That's what I think so many others who've worked with us have been about. And you know, we don't talk enough about lived values. You know, we talk about high abstract values, which are great, like social justice. That's a great value. But to embody in yourself the idea that you're going to do good in this world, you're going to try to do that, I think that's what
it's interesting, you know, hearing you talk about the formation of the graduate program. It just strikes me that, you know, through a rather mundane vehicle of just sort of using the institutions of academia, you were able to create a revolutionary kind of community, the school of social medicine, if you will. But, you know, and I think that there's a lot of parallels with the work of Partners in Health and sort of taking advantage of existing vehicles that are seemingly mundane and applying them in ways that are revolutionary and have sort of pushed the envelope. And I just wonder, sort of at the time, have you sort of realized how revolutionary the work that you're doing? Have you sort of had to do it in a way covertly? do you have like a long game and a short game? Or because, you know, it seems like at the time, you know, it must have met a lot of resistance. And I'm just curious as to kind of how you were able to balance everything and making that happen.
Well, as you know, Nick, life is one damn thing after another. And in the context of that, when you look back, you try to give some form to it. But I mean, for example, I'll give you some of the mistakes that I've made to show you that there's no, and Paul, I'm sure, might be able to do this too, that there's no pattern that's sort of set out. You're sort of working along to, this is what I meant by move this along, move that along. When Paul, Jim, and Ophelia Dahl started PIH, I was very concerned. I thought they were making a mistake. I was so invested in the MD-PhD program that I feared that PIH would take them away from it. So rather than being and assisting them at the outset, I was a source of doubt on that. Now I made up for that in that it was under my tenure as chair of the department, which is now called Global Health and Social Medicine, that PIH came into the medical school. And there I had to lobby and actually place a lot of pressure on a very reluctant dean who didn't have the vision for PIH to come into the medical school. There was a time in which Paul was building his career and going back and forth between Haiti and the Brigham and Women. And I got called on a Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock and was told by the head of infectious diseases at the Brigham that unless Paul stayed all year round in the Brigham, they were going to give up their half of his salary. And so I came up with Paul's salary, half. I was already paying half, picked up the other half when I called Michael Crichton, who was one of the supporters of our program, and was able to come up with that part of the salary. And then I came in Monday morning and I went to my financial person. His name was Susan. I said, Susan, I don't understand. Paul has got all these grants. How is it I had all this pressure on me on Friday to come up with half his salary? And she said, oh, Arthur, she said, you know, he has a moral thing. He won't write his salary into his grants. And I called Paul in and I said, Paul, you've got a moral thing with the MacArthur Foundation, with the Rockefeller Foundation, with all these players, but you've got no moral thing with me. And anyway.
He got my salary.
That's beautiful.
You know.
I know that story. That's funny.
You know, just in hearing you ask the question, though, it makes me reflect. I think... as Arthur said, this could be done. The constitution of a revolutionary community that is really defined as a series of nodes, as Arthur said, this could be done anywhere, and we hope it will be done anywhere. The two of you as well, have reason to hope that this type of work and variations on it spread widely. But even if it could have happened anywhere, and Arthur mentioned a number of universities where, you know, I agree entirely. It didn't have any mystical attachment to Cambridge. But what it does have an attachment to is the notion of attachment, of being connected to a place and a time. And in an intellectual or scholarly manner, that is how anthropologists and social historians and physicians alike go into their research work, is assuming that there will be things that they can discover about this time and place that would make them feel passionate about health and social justice. So in a way, we anchored the abstract on the specific. We leveraged our own passions for work that we did, Arthur in China and you know, me in Haiti, and going right through the list. We leveraged that to build this machinery in these institutions. And You know, I feel like Arthur has been much better at building a discipline, you know, medical anthropology. I've tried to make my contributions, but they aren't, you know, signal ones like Arthur's are. But, you know, I've been very focused on building institutions, including physical institutions like teaching hospitals, a university. And, you know, that really comes out of this conversation that I've been having with Arthur and Ophelia and Jim and others. This is a conversation we've been having for decades. And so you would expect that it would evolve over time, just like our relationship has. But I think it's a really wonderful question. How does that specificity relate to, you know, what you've been able to move forward?
It's really beautiful. It's clear there's just an overwhelming sense of family and love in not just what you do, but in championing each other in the community that I think is a testament of how much you've been able to accomplish. Before I go on to the last set of questions that I have actually about current events, I wanted to ask each of you a little quick tangential question that I think could be interesting for our viewers, and that's, or listeners rather. When was the last time Paul and Arthur, each of you were on the wards or in clinic? And how much of your time do you spend recognizing it may not actually be on traditional wards or clinic, actually seeing patients these days?
Well, I mean,
I'm 80 years of age, so I gave up my clinical practice about 10 years ago. And I think in the, you know, I probably it was 3 or 4 years ago that I was still active, I think, in clinical teaching. I'm not really active in clinical teaching anymore, but there was a time in which I was very active in clinical teaching for 17 years. In spite of being in China and having been split between Cambridge and Boston, the medical school and the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, even when I was the chair of the social medicine department, I ran a clinical rounds at the Cambridge Hospital, what used to be called the Cambridge Hospital, for internal medicine residents, which was a continuation of what I had done at the University of Washington. But Paul is an active clinician to today.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that I draw on clinical practice in my social medicine and medical anthropology writing and teaching. I mean, it's not that I feel that I do. That's the main font of inspiration for me. And it is different for, you know, for other people. Some get their main source of inspiration from other parts of the work. But for me, it was always clinical medicine. And I also learn better about a new place through clinical work. It just, for some reason, the totalizing frameworks of anthropology and the grandiose aspirations of anthropologists, you know, they secretly thrill me, of course. But I always feel like I'm not going to quite be able to live up to them. These broad understandings of the social world in which we live. But getting at that world through clinical experience, through the lived experience of illness, and of course accompanying others through it, that is congenial to me. I know I can do that. So I'm unlikely to let go of the clinical connection. It's just vital to the rest of the work for me. And I've grown accustomed to working largely with very critically ill patients or critically injured patients. So whereas back in the day, I saw a lot more primary care patients or even primary care infectious disease patients, you know, people with AIDS or TB. But now I'm seeing people who are really very, very sick, and they tend to have an infection and a malignancy and an injury, you know. So that's all teamwork. And I like the teamwork part of it. You know, that requires a mental health team, physical therapy team, oncology, infectious disease. And, you know, this surprises people because I'm, you know, pretty well known in some circles for interest in community health and community medicine. But personally, clinically, my preferred area of practice is critical care.
Well, and I feel like, Paul, you've had so many folks you're connected to. I mean, you're so connected across the world that have become quite sick, and you've had to sort of intervene as an advocate, you know, and a doctor, I guess, but, you know, whether it's tetanus in Haiti or cancer in Haiti or, you know, COVID, or, you know, you've had so many people you're connected to who have become critically ill, and you've sort of stepped in at crucial moments to make sure that they get the care that they need in ways that are, you know, not totally conventional, but absolutely necessary. And I feel like you're still very connected through those situations as well.
Thank you, Vic.
Yeah.
You know, again, that little smile on your face, that's the smile of a chief resident. Because, you know, this intense way of living outside your family, think about it. You know, we really do that when we go off to a university, if we're lucky enough to go off to a university. And then, you know, the way that the way that you are in a new community, if you're an anthropologist in a place that you didn't grow up and you usually don't speak the language and are learning it, you know, that's an intense experience. But there's also that intense experience of being a resident, working with the residency directors and the chief residents, is you learn a lot about how to be in a family that's around it, you know, that's together for 80 hours a week. And so I think that some of this work that Arthur and I do, and the way we do it in different and complementary ways, it also comes from being trained as physicians.
Yeah. A big influence on me has two of them. One was that most of my work in psychiatry was actually with psychiatry in chronic illness. So my specialty in psychiatry was called consultation liaison psychiatry. And I would treat depression, anxiety in the context of someone with diabetes, heart disease, cancer, et cetera. And that made me very much chronic disease oriented. And then if you look at, you know, where the big problem is anyway in the mental health field, it's also in the chronic disease side. But the real learning experience for me that was outside of the clinic was when I took care of my wife for 10 years. And that experience, I think, cemented for me the importance of families in care, families as caregivers, families as part of the team of care, or not part of the team of care. And I'll just point out that when my wife, late wife Joan, who was a fantastic woman, was really, really feeling the effects of Alzheimer's, and she had an unusual form that made her blind. So she had both dementia and blindness at the same time. Every month, no matter whether he was in Africa or Haiti, Paul would call her on the phone, the satellite phone, to speak with her. It meant a great deal to her. And that showed the connection, I think, that we've had, which is very personal. Anyone who knows Paul knows that that's who he is. He's deeply personal. And I think that's been a very important part of what we've done. And if you speak to undergraduates, you'll see the influence on them, even if they don't go into medicine or public health, but do something else. I'm constantly meeting former undergraduates who took our course, and they say two things to me. One, how important the course has been, but also that they only completed the reading the last 2 years, where they've been away for 20 years, 15 years. They said, oh, the reading's great, but I really only got to it last year, but you guys were the centerpiece of my experience. Yeah.
I think that's an incredible segue, just hearing Paul, how you called Joan to check in on her, I didn't realize that deep connection. If anyone's read Arthur's book, you realize how really beautiful that relationship is between you and Joan, Arthur. personally just reminds me of my own with my grandma. But just thinking about that, thinking about the work you've had on caregiving and how you've drawn inspiration from your own life, I thought it would be a good segue also to talk a little bit about some current public health challenges we're facing, namely the COVID-19 crisis and a lot of the, how much it's exposed some of our challenges with respect to caregiving and elder care and public trust that I think overlaps lessons that both of you have shared through your works and experience. I'll leave it for either of you to share your thoughts, but how have you been thinking about the current public's response to the COVID-19 pandemic in this country and elsewhere? Are there any lessons that your own works have provided that you think would be valuable for us to learn?
You start, Paul, then I'll come in.
Well, you know, I've been looking, Sharif, at the very, very big picture and the very small picture. I mentioned earlier that I feel like I can learn about a place and a time best through clinical cases and clinical medicine. But in this instance of COVID, the place where I've been the most has been Boston, and I already know something about Boston. And so the big picture, the small picture approach has really been clinical. How does the virus get in the body? You know, how is this enormous variation in risk being embodied? How is this enormous variation in clinical course being embodied? These are the kind of questions that Arthur taught his students to ask, maybe in different terms, those, you know, years ago, but the big picture, I've been really fascinated all my life by the willingness to dismiss, you know, medical intervention on behalf of other people, like to say, oh no, that's not feasible, not cost effective, not sustainable, not prudent, you know, that this intervention, that's always blown me away. You know, you go to a place in Southern Africa where 30% of the population, a young adult population, is living with HIV. There is therapy for HIV that's effective. And then there are a lot of people saying it's not cost effective, feasible, sustainable. That just blew me away the first time I understood it. And that was in Haiti. So I call that clinical nihilism, and it's not a creative term. I'm sure plenty of people do. And so I've looked for it all over the world and fought it along with, you know, thousands of coworkers. But what I've been seeing recently in the United States is containment nihilism. It's like we're giving up in some places in this country on containing the epidemic. And that, I have to admit, surprises me. Or surprised me. Now I'm getting used to it. So that's just an example of insights from past work on epidemics that have allowed me to see the current one with some clarity, I believe. And that happens again and again. I have a big debt to anthropology and to Arthur.
Thank you. Yeah, that's really insightful. Arthur, what have been your thoughts?
Well, the only thing I'd add, I mean, Paul said it beautifully, and I totally agree with him. I think that I learned taking care of my wife that you had to have rituals in the course of the day in order to order the day and get through it and endure it and keep going. And I did an op-ed piece on this and how important that had also been for me in isolation in the COVID epidemic to organize my day around rituals and having an order to the day that flowed on its own. And I in that particular op-ed piece had a tremendous response to it. was put on YouTube at more than 100,000 visits. And it made me realize that there are a lot of people out there looking for ways of dealing with this pandemic in their own lives. And we've had such poor communication about it at the and so many poor examples at the highest level. And I just come back to the last point that Paul made, which I think is the most important point for us right now. And this is something that he really taught me. Not to accept the public health view of standards that are limited by the economic realities that we find ourselves in. To emphasize the importance of saying, why not spend more? We want the most if the most important part of our lives is giving care and receiving care, then it's going to be costly. And we got to spend for it. And why should we ask the question anyway of that these people get care and those people don't get care? Everyone deserves care. And I think the public health view, which limits this to only what is economically acceptable within the economic terms of our society and our times, I think that's been one of Paul's really great critiques. And I come right along with that. I follow him. Exactly in this.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support us, please leave a review on Apple Podcast or whichever podcast platform you use. And if there's something you found you really liked, or didn't like, or would like to make a suggestion, feel free to reach out by email at info@tdio.org. Thank you.